Good afternoon. We have one case this afternoon. It's the complaint of Christopher Columbus v. Michael Bacchino et al. Mr. Wooster.
Thank you, Judge Hardiman. May it please the Court. Dan Wooster for the appellant, Christopher Columbus, LLC. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
The issue in this case is whether claims against the owner of a commercial passenger vessel for injuries allegedly incurred on a cruise on navigable waters as a result of crew member negligence is a case within the maritime jurisdiction. The claimants here allege that the crew members in the course of this cruise committed numerous acts of negligence, over-serving alcohol, failing to supervise passengers as they went about the vessel, failing to intervene in an alleged altercation that supposedly took place on the vessel, and failing to provide safe egress from the vessel. Those are all classic maritime negligence claims that are commonly seen in passenger cases.
Counsel, where do we look? What is our source material to ascertain whether there's admiralty jurisdiction here?
We look to the allegations in the pleadings.
And are the pleadings here, I mean, if we're looking to your client's complaint, then what we have is an initial complaint that alleges that the altercation took place following the docking, and it incorporates by reference the original state complaint, which makes clear on its face that the allegation is that the altercation took place after the boat was docked in the parking lot. As that could be relevant, maybe dispositive to jurisdiction, is that what we're limited to? Do we look to those pleadings?
I don't think you're limited to initial pleadings. If you look at the claims themselves that the passengers have made in the limitation action, they clearly say that the injuries, supposed injuries, happened during the cruise as the vessel was docking. Only one of the claimants is contending that he was injured both on the vessel and on the pier immediately after the vessel berthed.
But those claims are filed responsive documents, and they contradict the allegations of the original state complaint.
Well, the original state complaint was a little unclear as to exactly where the assault took place. In subsequent filing, Mr. Bacchino was effectively the equivalent of a Rule 16 conference in state court. He clarified in that memo being submitted to the court that the altercation happened both on the vessel and on the dock after the vessel berthed. So according to his contentions in the state court, and this was before we filed the limitation case, there was a kind of a spillover effect. The altercation began on the vessel and spilled over onto the dock in the close environs of the gangway.
You agree that in ascertaining jurisdiction, we should be looking to the documents, not, as the district court here did, make an assumption about what those jurisdictional facts might be, taking them in the light most favorable to jurisdiction?
Well, the judge did make a comment in that respect as far as there's a factual dispute whether a fight even happened. And in setting up this sua sponte motion or order that he issued, he basically said, I'm going to assume that the facts are such that would best support maritime jurisdiction. But that was only a distinction between whether the fight happened after the vessel was already fully secured to the pier or whether it began as the vessel was still coming in to the berth. So that was the only factual resolution, if you want to call it that he made in the order. There was no hearing. There was no evidentiary hearing. But in a normal case, in any case that comes before the federal court, you'd ascertain jurisdiction based on what the parties have alleged. And all the allegations here are that this so-called assault happened began on the vessel, and in the case of one claimant, it spilled over onto the pier.
But in the process of docking?
Well, the testimony, I mean, the parties weren't focusing like a laser on that issue because it's not important to the merits of the case.
Regardless of where they were focusing, we have to look at what they've pleaded. And there's no allegation, is there, the fight occurred in the middle of the Delaware River. It was, as Judge Krause said, it was in the process of docking. That was
the allegation, right? Was to the effect that the vessel was coming into dock. It was slowly slowing down, coming into the dock. And as you would expect, when five, six, seven different people are deposed, there are slight variations in the case. But I think that goes to show the problem with telescoping in so closely on, you know, one person's recollection versus another, just to try to find out whether the case belongs in federal court.
All right, and the parties agree that location and traditional maritime activity was satisfied, right?
That's right.
Isn't the focus here on potentially disruptive impact on maritime commerce?
Yes, as to 1333.
All right, in our opinion in Hargis, we held no jurisdiction, so tell us why there was not a potentially disruptive impact on maritime commerce in that case, but there is in your case.
Well, Your Honor, Hargis is a bit of a one-off case as we see it. There wasn't even any argument in that case from the plaintiff who invoked the court's jurisdiction in that case. It was a one-sided oral argument. No one appeared in the court to defend the lower court's judgment. So it's a little bit of a...
Be that as it may, we have to accept it, unless absent of en banc. You either have to distinguish that case or...
I do.
You have to get this case unbanked in order to prevail.
Yeah,
So why don't you try to distinguish that case?
I think you can distinguish it in a number of respects. First of all, there was no allegation in that case that the crew members had committed any act of negligence while the vessel was navigating in a navigable waterway, as there is here. Second point is, and I don't think these are jurisdictionally relevant, if you want to be accurate about it, but it was a small motorboat anchored in knee-deep water. Our vessel is more than 80 feet long. It has three passenger decks. It's a commercial passenger vessel, certified to carry 259 passengers, 40 crew members, just a complete different scale than this motorboat that was run up on the beach in St. John's Cruz Bay Harbor. But more to the point, with all due respect to that panel, I don't think that the way they characterized the incident in that case for purposes of ascertaining commercial disruption was faithful or consistent with the approach that the court en banc set out in Neely, which basically says follow Grubart to the letter. The incident should be described as damage by a vessel to, and then fill in the blank, who was injured or what was injured. That would have been by a vessel to a passenger. And regardless of the rather unique facts in Hargis, any time a pet is injured on board a vessel in navigable waters, perforce there's a potential disruption to maritime commerce. And we don't look at the particular facts in the case. That's what Grubart said over and over again. Assistant said the same thing. You come up with a general formulation of what happened, what's the case about on a very general level, and then you can conceive of all different ways that might interrupt commerce.
Well, we look at it at an intermediate level of generality, not just as a general matter.
Yeah.
So what would be wrong with looking at the intermediate level of generality here as presenting an altercation between passengers on a vessel in navigable waters in the process of docking?
Well, in the process of docking is not a jurisdictionally relevant feature in any case. I mean, if you go back 150 years, vessels have been alongside the dock fully secured. They're not even moving. They're fully secured, and an accident happens on board while the vessel's in port.
Isn't it relevant, though, to whether there's a substantial impact on commerce?
No, it does not have to be a substantial impact. It has to be a potential impact.
Right.
Based on the general features of the incident.
How can an altercation that takes place on a boat that's in the dock or just about in the dock disrupt maritime commerce?
Well, we don't think it's appropriate to
speculate about that, right?
Yeah, it is a form of speculation, but that's what CISM directed us to do. That case involved no commercial activity at all, purely private pleasure boats docked at a marina, not doing anything. They were actually docked, just sitting there overnight when the fire broke out. And the court.
That's why I thought you'd be happy with the formulation of in the process of docking, because that gets you closer to maritime activity than a ship that's already docked.
Well, if the court wants to put that formulation on, I mean, that's the inherent problem with the test we have.
Your point is that, fine, you'll take it, but that's that's not jurisdictionally relevant.
Yeah.
What's jurisdictionally relevant is where there's a potentially disruptive impact on commerce, and even a boat that's been docked for 6 months, if it catches fire or what have you and, you know, burns or causes the dock to be damaged, your argument, as I understand it, is that's potentially disruptive.
Exactly. Yeah.
But we're looking at the formulation in its entirety. I mean, if the activity that's at issue ends up being a fire on a boat that's docked and has the potential to make the entire, to spread to other boats and to make the pier itself unusable for some period of time, one could see how that would affect maritime commerce. Here, we're dealing with an activity of an altercation. So don't we need to see something in the location and timing part of this formulation that would get this to affecting maritime commerce for there to be a jurisdiction?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Assuming we want to get that specific, I don't think that's appropriate, but if we do want to be that specific, an altercation breaks out, what's the first thing the crew is instructed to do? Call the captain. Anytime there's a casualty or an incident on board of any serious magnitude, first thing you do is call the captain. At the very time when he's bringing the vessel into the berth, he needs to be paying attention to his navigation, he needs to be paying attention to the wind and the current, his maneuvering with the wheel and the propellers. At the very time he's getting a phone call from down below, there's a massive fight that's broken out, call the Coast Guard. People are hurt. So that's just, I mean, one example of what could happen. The fight itself could damage the vessel. There's an allegation in our case that tables and chairs were collapsing in the midst of this veritable melee, as one claimant described it. That's damage to the vessel. That damage would have to be repaired. The vessel could be taken out of service while that's being done. The vessel owner's losing money when the vessel's not working.
That would be enough to affect maritime commerce?
Well, look at the 11th Circuit's case in the Doe versus the cruise line case. That was an assault completely off the vessel, onshore, and they said the mere fact that this is a commercial passenger vessel and the publicity that's inherent when an assault happens, that's going to damage their bookings in future case. Future potential customers are going to maybe not take a cruise that they otherwise would have. That was the only basis for a potential interruption in that case, and that was sufficient in their view.
That's a little bit perilous, though, isn't it? What's the limiting principle? If negative publicity is enough, is there any tort that could be committed on a cruise vessel that would not be deemed to plausibly or possibly disrupt maritime commerce?
There's some suggestion in some of the case law, Judge Harmon, that, for example, if someone's on a cell phone on the vessel and they make a call to shore and they phone in a derogatory or a defamatory statement to the newspaper or something, the fact that they're standing on the vessel when they make the call has nothing to do with maritime commerce. They could have been standing anywhere. And the vessel's not implicated in that case. The vessel crew's not privy to that conversation. The vessel crew's not being held at fault or attempting to be held at fault for that phone call. So to the extent the tort occurred on the vessel, it had nothing to do with the vessel's operation or its work on the navigable waters. That could arguably be outside the maritime jurisdiction. But for the run-of-the-mill injury claims,
slip and falls, all that.
Look,
anything that could distract the crew from navigating on the water. In fact, we had one case, I guess, where the vessel wasn't operable, and then that caused the tugboat to hit it. Vessel wasn't operating, but it was in the navigable waterway, and it caused a lot of trouble for others.
Exactly.
So it's not without limit, but you'd concede, would you not, that it's a very, very broad grant of jurisdiction. That's sort of the essence of your argument.
And I think if you look at where this connection test arose, Executive Jet's concern was we're getting some oddball cases that fall into the admiralty courts, like someone driving off a bridge and ending up in the river. Well, that doesn't belong in the admiralty court in Executive Jet's view, and that's perfectly understandable because it doesn't implicate a vessel. Or swimmers crash into each other on the beach.
Well, that's what I understand about the jet case. I don't know why they just didn't say that a plane crashing in a swamp, not a vessel.
Well, I think that would have been a more straightforward way to resolve the case, and in hindsight...
Because clearly a plane in the water does disrupt maritime commerce, right?
Indeed. And if it had crashed on the high seas, it would have been within the jurisdiction under the Deaths on the High Seas Act. So,
should we think of Executive Jet as... modifying Section 1333 itself, or think about it as a way to interpret constitutional admiralty jurisdiction?
Well, the Constitution says all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction are within fair game for the federal courts. The original Judiciary Act in 1789 basically parroted that language and said any case of maritime or admiralty jurisdiction is triable in the federal courts. But the Supreme Court has always kind of, you know, set up some boundaries as far as in defining what is an admiralty case. I think they're construing the statute. No case that I'm aware of has ever said Congress has passed a statute that's very broad and it surpasses the concept of admiralty that the Constitution sets forth. So Congress is always free to modify and extend the admiralty jurisdiction. That's what they did in the Genesee Chief case. Originally, the jurisdiction was confined to tidal waters. Congress, by statute, extended it to the Great Lakes and then to the Western Rivers. Both of those extensions were upheld, even though at the time of the founding, those rivers would not have been considered within the admiralty jurisdiction.
But it's expanding jurisdiction, right? It's limitable to it.
Yeah, I think it's a jurisprudential limit on 1333 is how I would view it, to keep out these oddball swimmer cases. And
do we need to agree with that premise to conclude that the Limitations Act would provide an independent basis for jurisdiction?
Do you need to I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Do we need to agree with that premise to adopt the position that you would have us take as to the Limitations Act, that provides an independent basis for jurisdiction?
Yes. You don't need to take any view. I mean, our position is that the Limitation Act itself, quite apart from 1333, supplies jurisdiction as the Act was construed in the Richardson case. And the Act and the Limitation Act in substance has remained the same as it was then. The operative language now is that the vessel may bring an action in a district court of the United States for limitation of liability as provided under this chapter. That's a separate grant of jurisdiction, in our view, separate and apart from 1333. I mean, that's effectively the same language that, Osborne versus the bank. It provided the right to sue and be sued in the circuit courts, and that was considered to be a grant of jurisdiction to hear that kind of a case.
But if we accept your argument on that, we're going against seven circuits that have said otherwise, right?
You are indeed, but you're going with the Supreme Court, and I'm comfortable with our position.
Your first argument is we don't have to get there because there's general admiralty jurisdiction.
You don't have to. And the third thing is the Admiralty Extension Act itself. Which I think there is admittedly a split of authority on that, but I think it's most reasonably construed as an independent grant without piling on this additional jurisprudential limit that developed from Executive Jet. Well, goodness, Your Honors, I haven't looked at my light in a long time.
It's not your fault. We've been lobbing a lot of questions your way, and you've answered them. Thank you. We'll see you on rebuttal, Mr. Wooster. Let's hear from Mr. Gruber, please.
Talk about youth versus age. The contrast is a little overwhelming for me. May it please the Court, my name is Stan Gruber. I'm here on behalf of the claimant appellee, Michael Bocchino. It seems to me that this case graphically illustrates the tension that results when you attempt to engraft the law of admiralty on a factual scenario that typically and traditionally is adjudicated by a state court and jury or a federal court under diversity, but by a court and jury as opposed to the law of admiralty.
You're saying that when someone's on a pleasure cruise on the Delaware River and they fall off the boat, that that would be adjudicated in a state court?
No, I'm not saying that.
That's an admiralty case, right?
Pardon me?
That would be an admiralty case.
If they were out in open waters and he fell off, absolutely.
So, and what if he's 4 yards from shore and he falls off?
I think that would still be an admiralty case.
And they're 10 yards from the dock and he falls into the water.
Possibly an admiralty case, but when you're along the side of the dock, it's a whole different scenario.
Okay, what case or statute tells us that the line of demarcation between admiralty jurisdiction and non-admiralty is when you're next to the dock?
Well, the line of cases that talk about, you know, a scenario that can potentially disrupt maritime commerce, the closer you get to that dock, the less likely that there's a chance that you're going to realistically disrupt maritime commerce. Because as the closer you get to that dock, the less danger there is that you're going to have to call somebody, a Coast Guard, as was mentioned, or another vessel to come and rescue.
What if the captain gets really close to the dock, as in doesn't calculate the wind properly and knocks the dock to pieces? Admiralty or no?
That would be an admiralty case.
Sure, because it has great potential to adversely affect maritime commerce. And so I don't understand why a melee wouldn't at least potentially, well, let's start with this. Do you agree that it's a theoretical test, not an actual test?
That's correct.
Okay. So why wouldn't a melee theoretically disrupt maritime commerce? Because the crew would be distracted by the melee, there could be physical injury, you'd have to call the Coast Guard, you might have to drop anchor, any number of things might be triggered by a melee on a pleasure ship like this.
I would agree if the vessel was out on the open water, but that's not the scenario here. It's very important that vessel is at dockside.
Do you agree? Have you conceded for purposes of our jurisdictional determination that we are confronted with a vessel in the process of docking?
Well, I agree that that's the scenario that trial court afforded, and I can't really argue with that. In my opinion, the vessel was already docked. The facts indicate that, but that was a determination that was made.
How about the pleadings that we look to for jurisdiction? Don't the claims that were filed, the responsive filing in the district court, disavow that the boat was already docked and say explicitly that it was still in the process of docking when the altercation broke out?
Absolutely. That's absolutely the case. It was not a factor that was considered by the trial court, unfortunately, and not raised by us, candidly.
Why shouldn't we remand this? It seems, wouldn't it have been prudent for the trial judge to have some jurisdictional discovery here to ascertain the true pleaded facts?
There was a good deal of discovery that took place in this case. We're really working on a record. It's almost like a motion for summary judgment, really. Because we're working on a record where there were several depositions taken, there were answers to interrogatories, documents produced, like you would normally have. Because there was never a motion to dismiss under 12b-6 or 12b-1, I guess, more importantly. So the reason the question of jurisdiction came up, as you'll recall, is because the judge raised it on his own motion. So you don't have the typical type of situation where you have a motion and you don't really have a record. Here you have a record. And based on that record, which normally a court wouldn't have in reaching a characterization as to the nature of the incident, based on the record, the trial judge came up with a conclusion that this would be the best way of describing it in the immediate process of docking. You'll recall from his opinion, he said there was a significant amount of evidence that it was already docked. And there was some other evidence that was an immediate process of docking.
Your client at this point, if I understand you correctly, and in the pleadings that are in the record, does not dispute that the boat was in the process of docking when the altercation broke out, that the injuries were incurred both on the boat while it was still docking and after it docked and the altercation continued in the parking lot.
We think the facts demonstrate that the vessel was already docked, but I think we're bound when the court says it was in the immediate process of docking. For purposes of this argument today, we're bound by that.
But don't we look to the allegations in the pleading to establish jurisdiction at the time of the filing in federal court? If it turns out in the course of discovery that one witness is determined to be more credible than the next, that doesn't undermine the jurisdiction that existed from the outset, right?
I agree with that.
But why wouldn't we consider the discovery you just described? Because it sounds like even though there wasn't a conscious effort to have, quote, jurisdictional discovery, unquote, that's in fact what happened in some respect.
I think that's true. I think that the facts with regard to jurisdiction can be deduced from what happened during discovery.
Mr. Cooper, did the discovery that you talk about disclose that your client was injured on the boat or when they were all hurried off the boat and onto the parking lot? Where did his injury
take place? My recollection of that is that the significant injury took place when he was off the boat on the pier.
But that's peculiar only to Mr. Bocchino.
That's correct.
The others are on the boat.
I believe that's the case, yes. Yeah. So, if I can go back, I guess, to where I was.
Sure.
It seems to me that the two cases that really control the issue of whether the connection test has been satisfied is the Hargis case, which Your Honor referred to, decided only a few months ago by another panel of this court, and the Tandon versus Captain's Cove Second Circuit decision in 2014, which was heavily relied upon by the trial court and heavily relied upon by the court in Hargis. Now, in both of those cases, the injuries sustained were as a result of acts of violence which occurred while the vessel was at dockside. That's why I think the fact that the vessel is at dockside is very significant.
Well, Hargis, there was no dock.
Well, Hargis, the vessel was anchored
in waist-deep or knee-deep water. Well, they brought a small boat up to Cruz Bay and threw the anchor overboard, and they jumped out of the boat and walked ashore.
But it had to be close to shore. I say dockside. I don't know whether there was a dock or there wasn't a dock in Hargis, to tell you the truth. I know that the captain of the boat was standing on the shore, and he was close enough to the vessel to throw a coffee cup and have it hit the plaintiff in the head. So,
well, he's very close to the shore, but I guess I challenge you on your description of it docking, because bringing a boat ashore and dropping anchor is less likely to affect maritime commerce than some mishap that would occur at dockside, because other boats need to use the dock. Other boats don't need to use the beach.
Well, here we get into the specific facts of this case. Theoretically, it's true that other boats need to use the dock. I believe in the facts of this case, the dock was actually a parking lot that the boat tied up to. It wasn't a marina where there were boats that were tied up all over the place.
But you agreed at the outset that the test we're applying is a theoretical one. That is, if it could disrupt maritime commerce.
If it had a realistic potential for disrupting maritime commerce, I think that
more
is
more
the
than
test.
Fanciful.
Not a fanciful one, exactly.
And the Second Circuit in Tandon, and part of its reasoning was that the boat was already docked, so there wasn't the risk of distracting the crew and the other disruption of maritime commerce that might follow from that. Doesn't that just point up that if we take the facts as last pleaded in the claims in the district court, if it's the boat is still in the process of docking, it's still moving, and the crew is still needed to perform their duties to avoid other accidents and injuries occurring, Tandon would seem to suggest that there would be maritime jurisdiction, there would be admiralty jurisdiction in that circumstance.
Well, I guess that's the problem. You have to interpret what is meant by the immediate process of docking. What I consider that to mean is that the lines are out and it's not fully tied up, the gangway hasn't been put down. But under that scenario, does that have a potential for disrupting other passengers in the waterway? Does that have the potential for injuring another vessel or injuring the dock? Does that have the potential of calling in rescue at sea? Whereas if somebody's hurt at dock, you call the police. You call rescue. They come right to dockside. I mean, realistically, that's, I think, what the reasoning in Tandon and Hargis really gets to. What is a realistic type of item that would cause a disruption of maritime commerce? And when you have the vessel tied up at dock...
Is it realistic, though? I mean, I think you have a really strong argument. If realistic means, you know, 51%, then I think you're going to win. But is realistic really the test? I think it's potentially disruptive, and the cases seem to suggest that if it's 1 in 10, you know, 10% or maybe even a 5%, that, you know. Well, in one of the cases, there was a scuba gear was sunk, right?
Yes.
You know, so the odds of a boat hitting that were probably very slim, but, you know, there's a chance.
But that's I view realistic as being a definite component, and I think that the
is realistic of a probability. Or how do we quantify that in our minds? I mean,
that's the problem with the connection test.
Right. I'm asking whether potentially is the same as realistic. They don't seem to be the same to me. Potentially seems like a much easier test for your opponents to meet than the realistic test.
Well, that's why I think potentially is not that much different than physically. I mean, we know that there are any number of, you know, incredible scenarios that can take place, but are they realistic? Is it something that you would expect to happen? Would you expect that the vessels alongside the
dock? I wouldn't expect the Maylie to break out on the Franklin yacht either, but it did, apparently.
Would you expect that vessel at dockside could harm another vessel or disrupt the waterway or cause a maritime rescue when it's right there at dockside where the police and the fire and rescue can be called? I mean, that's how the trial court looked at it. And I think that's really the spirit of the Hargis and Tandon cases as well.
Mr. Gruber, can we go back for a moment, because this may have implications for whether we have the facts needed to ascertain jurisdiction, or a remand is required. You seemed to be saying earlier that it's now your position in that the injuries occurred not on the boat but on the dock. And that would contradict the claim of your client that says that he denies that claiming was assaulted on the vessel following the cruise. It is averred, on the contrary, that the assault was initiated during the course of the cruise while the claimant was still on board the vessel and the vessel was in the process of docking. Claimant was assaulted by several other passengers. Now, those allegations obviously have other implications too for privity and for liability. Is it your position that those representations in the complaint, you're now disavowing? Mr. Pichino's position is the assault took place only on the dock and not on the boat.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the fight broke out on the vessel, but the significant injuries sustained by Mr. Bocchino took place ashore. The fight started on the vessel. There's no doubt about that. And he was involved on the vessel, but it was not until he got down on the shore that he really got hammered.
So are we agreed then in the relevant activity that we are assessing for jurisdiction purposes, it could be described as an altercation between passengers on a vessel in navigable waters in the process of docking? Is there any part of that that you disagree with?
Not for purposes of this argument, to make it simple. I mean, I don't feel that's an accurate description of what happened. I think the vessel was already docked, but that would be my interpretation of the facts, but it wasn't the trial court's, and I don't think I can substitute for purposes of this argument, how I feel, what I feel the facts
demonstrate. But it's also not your client's pleading, correct? And you're not disavowing those pleadings?
I think the pleading by the client said the vessel was in the process of docking.
I'm reading the language from the claim. While claimant was still on board the vessel and the vessel was in the process of docking, claimant was assaulted by several other passengers.
Well, that's what it says. I can't argue with that, Your Honor.
It's essentially a negligence claim, right?
Absolutely.
So where did the negligence take place?
Negligence took place in allowing the people who did the assaulting to be served alcohol when they were drunk.
So
that took
water.
Place during the voyage.
Right.
And in not protecting Mr. Volcano and the other people who were injured when the fight broke out.
I thought you were going to say the negligence occurred when they charged different prices for the spirits between the two warring factions.
You could argue that, but that certainly was a precursor to what occurred. That's for sure. I guess I should just say that as far as the Limitation Act and the Extension of Admiralty Act, when Congress wants to give a statute jurisdictional effect, it typically says so in very clear language. It specifically will say that the jurisdiction is conferred upon the district courts to hear cases under this statute. So in the case of both of those statutes, you don't have anything specific in the language of the statute that confers jurisdiction. The Admiralty Extension Act says that jurisdiction is extended to incidents involving damage to persons or property ashore. But that really means that whatever the Admiralty law is, whatever the law is on jurisdiction, extended to those types of cases. Which, of course, those cases, the Act was enacted long before the Executive Jet Rubart line of cases. The legislative history does not indicate any intention to confer jurisdiction on those statutes. And the case law, basically, the reasoning behind the case law supports that those two statutes do not confer independent jurisdiction. I just want to say real quickly, I know my time's up, but the easiest way to have handled this case would have been for the court to grant the motion for summary judgment, which was made on the grounds that there are no set of circumstances where the vessel could establish a lack of privity or knowledge of the negligent acts which were alleged here. Because the owner of the vessel was present throughout the voyage, the owner of the vessel admitted that he was the vessel's safety officer, and he was in charge of the service of alcohol on the vessel. So whether it be actual knowledge or constructive knowledge, which can be imparted onto the owner, there's no doubt that there could never be a scenario where the owner could have established a lack of privity or knowledge of the negligent acts that were going on.
But we can only reach those issues that go to liability under the limitation if we actually have jurisdiction, right?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
We could only reach those issues that go to liability under the Limitations Act if there were jurisdiction.
Well, that's true, but you wouldn't have to get to the question of jurisdiction if you found there was no scenario under which the vessel could establish lack of privity or knowledge. The case would then be remanded to the state
issue
court.
That we always need to decide.
Pardon me?
Right. You're almost inviting the district court to have assumed arguendo that there was jurisdiction, and courts don't usually do that, right?
Well,
I mean, I understand the practical, you're making a wise practical point,
yes.
But jurisdiction is one of those things that we tend to take very seriously as a procedural matter.
Right, I mean, we have this case has dragged on for a long time. The claimant has been denied a jury trial for a long time. If the case does get remanded, it's going to get dragged out even further, and we're going to come back to that motion for summary judgment again. So it seems to me the practical thing here is to affirm, and I think that's what the law dictates in this situation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gruber.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Rebuttal, Mr. Wooster?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few quick points. counsel made the point that this is basically a fight case, an assault and battery case. It could be equally heard in state court. But the question is, I mean, when you're transporting passengers over land, that could be heard in state court. But when you're transporting passengers across the water on board a commercial vessel, you're an admiralty. When you're carrying cargo on the water, you're an admiralty. It doesn't matter that a trucking accident belongs in state court. There's something fundamentally different when you sue a vessel owner for what you say it did in the course of operating its vessel on navigable waters. Now, I understood counsel to say that if the vessel were 40 yards off the dock, it would be within maritime jurisdiction, but if it's 10 yards or less, it wouldn't be. And I think that just goes to show the inherent unworkability of the standard that the district court came up with and that the appellee is urging today. That's no way to set up a jurisdiction with 30 yards, 20 yards, 10 yards.
It's a line-drawing exercise, and the fact that you say even if it's docked for 6 months, I mean, that's a line that you're drawing, too, that's not a bright line either, right?
Well, the line is if you're on the vessel on navigable waters, you're an admiralty, and if something happens on that vessel, it's an admiralty claim.
But the case law says only if there's potential to disrupt maritime commerce.
Yes, and I think under 1333, and if you look at what they mean by potential, look at foremost.
Would you address this continuum of fanciful, potential, realistic?
Yeah, there either is a potential or there isn't.
Well, is that 0.0001% or is it 1% or 5%? Help us out.
I think if you can imagine in your mind a scenario by which this general kind of accident would disrupt commerce, that element is satisfied.
A 1 in a million shot is good enough?
I think if you characterize it properly, which is a general characterization, look at foremost where the vessels were on a bayou in state waters, miles from the ocean, and the Supreme Court said we're going to assess the potential of disruption by taking this collision and moving it thousands of miles to a busy commercial waterway that we can understand the potential impact it would have had if it had happened there. And this accident happened right on the main shipping channel, which runs right on the west side of the riverbank, right where this vessel berths. Tandon was by its terms limited to accidents on permanent docks. I think the judge in that case took pains to distinguish that, make that clear. And the same judge, Chief Judge Katzman, in a subsequent case decided just last summer, my light's on.
Go ahead.
Made it clear that that was a unique situation where the accident happened on the dock, had nothing to do with the operation of the vessel. Where the injury happens on the vessel, you're in a completely different scenario. The appellees took no cross-appeal on the denial of their summary judgment motion. We had our own summary judgment motion, which is still pending before the district court. Those are for the district court to decide in the first instance. This court does not have jurisdiction to pass on the merits of a summary judgment motion because there's no cross-appeal. And just finally on the Extension Act, the Act says that the maritime jurisdiction extends to and includes cases of injury by a vessel on navigable waters. So whatever maritime jurisdiction is under 1333, we know that it includes at least this category of cases in which there's a claim of injury by a vessel on navigable waters. That's a grant of jurisdiction. I think I commend Judge Posner's opinion to the panel. I think that makes that very clear. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Indulgence. The court thanks counsel for excellent briefing and even better oral argument. Mr. Gruber, we appreciate the fact that you have not held Mr. Wooster's youth and inexperience against him. And we appreciate what counsel have said about timing. I've always believed justice delayed is justice denied, and we will do the best we can to get an appropriate opinion to you in due course. And we'll take the matter under advisement. Thank you.